Thanks, Tom. I would, of course, like to join the other speakers in thanking the organizers for putting together such an exciting meeting and for giving me the opportunity to talk. And I'll be reviewing for you some more or less recent results of supersymmetry in curved space. So just as a little bit of warm-up, it's a standard tool in quantum field theory to turn on sources of various kinds and then study the response of the system. And an extremely elementary example is that if you have a theory with a global continuous flavor symmetry, then you can turn on a background gauge field A that couples to the conserved flavor current. And at the linearized level, the coupling just proceeds by multiplying A with J. And then there are also higher order terms, quadratic and A. And these higher order terms are called Siegel terms, and they're needed to ensure gauge invariance under gauge transformations of the background field A, or equivalently to enforce conservation of the flavor current. And the thing that's important to keep in mind here is that A is a non-dynamical background field, so in particular, it can be tuned to any value, and it doesn't satisfy any equations of motion. And if you want to study the theory for small values of A in a vicinity of the trivial value A equals 0, then that's equivalent to knowing all the correlation functions of the flavor current J mu in the original theory, in the theory with A equals 0, and that's just the philosophy of linear response theory. So this is extremely basic, and now we're going to play the same game, but we're going to use a different operator. So if you have a Poincaré invariant quantum field theory, then by definition it has a conserved symmetric stress energy tensor, T mu nu, and if you want to turn on a background field or a source for that operator, then the appropriate background field is a space-time metric, g mu nu. And I will only be discussing Euclidean theories, so weak-rotated theories, and in that case, g mu nu is a Riemannian metric. So again, we play the same game. We can expand g in small fluctuations around flat space, and then at the linearized level, the fluctuations in g just couple to the stress tensor, and then there are also higher-order Siegel terms. And again, at the linearized level, around flat space, the effect of these small perturbations in the metric is captured by correlation functions of the stress tensor. Now, with regard to these higher order terms, many of them are fixed by diffeomorphism invariants. So you can write down this coupling, and then you can try to complete this Lagrangian to something that's fully diffeomorphism invariant, and that fixes many of the higher order Siegel terms. And then once you have a diffeomorphism theory, you can place that on an arbitrary Riemannian manifold. So it doesn't need to be in any sense close to flat space. In particular, M can be a compact manifold. So this will be, yes?
Well, we probably assume that the TVU is gauge-invariant under all other possible gauges.
Absolutely.
Because that's your route, I think.
Whenever I say local operator, I will always mean gauge-invariant, well-defined, and so forth. My definition of a quantum field theory in this talk will be that it has a gauge invariance local conserved stress tensor. That's true. But what I'm doing right here is starting with an ordinary quantum field theory and proceeding from there. So I'm starting with something that has, at the very beginning, a gauge invariance stress tensor. Okay. So now, one comment that I would like to make now, and that I'll return to at various points in the talk, is that this procedure of making the Lagrangian diffeomorphism doesn't specify it uniquely. You can add curvature couplings, which are zero in flat space. And these can be interpreted as a choice of stress tensor T mu nu. So for example, if you change the stress tensor by a term like this, which is called an improvement term, which doesn't affect the conservation laws or the charges in flat space, then in curved space, that has the effect of shifting the Lagrangian by a curvature coupling proportional to the Ricci tensor, the Ricci scalar. So these curvature terms are something we'll come back to. And I'll introduce the observable that I'll be focusing on in most of the talk, and that's the partition function on M. So the partition function on the curved manifold M in the presence of the background metric and perhaps also a background gauge field for some flavor currents and perhaps other sources is simply the functional integral of all fields on that manifold. So in quantum field theory, that's an object that you might worry about because it is often ill-defined, especially in flat space. And there are two possible sources of problems. One are infrared divergences, but these are cured if M is a compact manifold, which will be the case of interest here. And the other problem could be UV ambiguities, which we sometimes call scheme dependence. And this is something we know how to take care of in a standard way by listing all the local counterterms that can affect the answer. So once we know which part of the answer is scheme independent, that's physical and an interesting observable. And here I just quickly review some of the interesting data that is associated with that observable. So of course, just like around flat space, if you know the dependence of the partition function on continuous variations of the metric and the background gauge field, then you can extract correlation functions of T and J. More interestingly, as was emphasized in various other talks, the partition function can detect global degrees of freedom, which are activated by the topology. So the classical example is Chern-Simons theory, which has no local correlation functions, but interesting partition functions. Now, if you have a conformal field theory, then for some choices of metric and M, the theory is related to flat space by a conformal transformation. So this means that there's a canonical way of fixing the curvature couplings in this case. And there are various important examples of that. For example, if you look at the theory on SD minus 1 times R, then states in that theory correspond to local operators in flat space. That's the usual state operator correspondence. And the partition functions on SD minus 1 times S1 count these local operators. Similarly, you can map the theory in flat space to a full SD. And you can map correlation functions from one to the other. And the SD basically acts as an infrared regulator in that case. And finally, as we have already heard in various other talks, the partition function on SD is closely related to certain entanglement entropies in flat space. So this makes Z a very interesting observable, well worth studying. But in general, computing it is very difficult. And this is a conventional situation where we turn to supersymmetry and ask if we can learn more. So in flat space, supersymmetry, of course, is well known to provide a powerful handle on the dynamics of field theory. And this is especially useful for studying protected, or BPS, observables that preserve some fraction of the supersymmetry. And those observables are typically restricted and depend on the various parameters and details of the theory in a very constrained way. And in favorable situations, they can be determined exactly. So an excellent example is the superpotential in four-dimensional n equals 1 theories. Now, we can try to ask whether there are similarly good protected observables in curved space that we can somehow learn something about using supersymmetry. And the problem that we run into almost immediately is that for generic choices of the manifold M and the background fields G and A, supersymmetry is broken. And that's simply a reflection of the fact that the stress tensor or the flavor current in flat space are generally not BPS operators. Okay? So we clearly need to do more in order to study supersymmetric theories in curved space. And what will end up happening is that preserving some amount of supersymmetry requires more data, more background fields, more operators that need to be turned on, and also additional geometric structure on M. So this immediately raises three natural questions, which will more or less be answered in the rest of the talk. So the first question is, when and how can we preserve supersymmetry on a curved manifold M? In that case, what extra data beyond the metric or the background field A is needed to specify the supersymmetric Lagrangian? And now, the partition function that I've defined on the previous slide can be simply viewed as the expectation value of the unit operator in curved space. And this is a BPS observable. And in the spirit of this flat space discussion, we can ask, how does that protected BPS observable depend on the data in the Lagrangian of the theory in curved space? So is it in some sense protected, and does it only depend on a subset of the full data? So I'll quickly go through a long list of various examples that I will not dwell on in too much detail. And there are many, many more that I'll have to leave out. But the original example that I want to emphasize is the notion of twisting, which was introduced by Witten long ago. Twisting is a setup where you consider a supersymmetric theory with an R symmetry in flat space. So assume the R symmetry is G sub R. If you have a curved manifold M with a metric of holonomy G holonomy, and the supercharge is a singlet under a suitably defined diagonal subgroup of the R symmetry group and the holonomy group, then there is a procedure for for preserving that supercharge in curved space. This is well known. And much of the recent interest in supersymmetry in curved space has been in backgrounds that do not fall into this class of twisted theories. So these backgrounds themselves fall into two subclasses. One of them consists of highly symmetric backgrounds that have a fairly rigid geometry and that preserve all or a lot of the supercharges of the flat space theory. So the first example that kind of kicked off this whole development was Pestrin's study of the n equals 2 theory on a round 4 sphere. And then there are many, many subsequent studies of supersymmetric theories on round spheres and also on spheres times circles that are closely related to supersymmetric indices. And I will return to some, but certainly not all of these examples throughout the talk. More recently, there has been a renewed emphasis on less symmetric backgrounds that preserve fewer supercharges. And these backgrounds are not rigid. They often come in continuous families, sometimes continuously infinite families, and depend on various parameters. So there's another example from n equals 2 theory that has been known for a long time, and that's the omega background of Nekrasov that depends on two parameters, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And more recently, people have taken these rigid backgrounds up here that preserve lots of supersymmetry and deformed them in various ways. So yes? Here, I will only consider the supercharges, Q, not the S supercharges. You could do that. That's also an interesting problem. But I will restrict myself to the non-conformal case here. There'll be a few comments about the conformal case in the end. So we now have an interesting class of backgrounds that depend on continuous parameters. And the case study, or the prototypical example that I would like to return to throughout the talk, is the squashed three-sphere. So if you take three-dimensional n equals 2 theories with an R-symmetry, then you can place them on a round 3-sphere and compute their partition function using supersymmetric localization. This is a fascinating story that will be reviewed later today in the talk by Brian Willett. And over the last few years, many authors have generalized this computation to so-called squashed spheres, where a squashed sphere is simply a manifold that's diffeomorphic to S3, but could have a much more complicated metric. And these metrics that can be analyzed this way not only contain arbitrary parameters, they can even contain arbitrary functions. However, if you do explicit localization computations on these spaces, you learn that the partition function only seems to depend on the geometry of the background through a single complex parameter B, which is usually called the squashing parameter. And moreover, there are some deformations of the background geometry that do not affect the partition function at all, even though the metric may change, sometimes in a complicated way. And more generally, other examples in this spirit suggest that the supersymmetric partition function on M only depends on a finite number of continuous parameters rather than all the data used to define the supersymmetric Lagrangian on M, which often depends on arbitrary functions. Oops. So in the remainder of the talk, I'll review a unified approach to studying supersymmetric theories on M. I will describe in some detail the data that enters the supersymmetric Lagrangian, and then I will try to explain how this data can or cannot affect the partition function Z sub M. And of course, I will have to omit many topics and examples and references. For example, I will only restrict myself to the case of R-symmetric theories with four supercharges in four dimensions, and then also at the end a little bit in three dimensions. And the only observable I will discuss is the partition function, even though there are many other interesting observables. However, I would like to emphasize that the methods are general and they can be applied to many other examples with varying degrees of supersymmetry in the literature. So this is the plan for the rest of the talk. And one of the points will be to return to the squashed sphere at the end and see if we can say something about it. So if you take 4D n equals 1 theories with an R symmetry and you try to couple them to a curved background, then you start with the observation that now the stress energy tensor resides in a supermultiplet together with other currents. And because the theory has an R symmetry, we are going to focus on the so-called R multiplet, which contains the R symmetry current of the theory, the stress tensor, but also the supersymmetry current S, and another conserved two-form current C. This is the stress tensor multiplet in flat space. And just like the stress tensor controls the coupling to gravity in a general non-supersymmetric theory, this multiplet controls the coupling to curved space and to curved background fields in a supersymmetric theory. And because the appropriate background fields contain the metric and various other fields that couple to these operators, the background field multiplet that's appropriate here is a supergravity multiplet. So we have, of course, the linearized metric coupling to T, but we also have a gravitino coupling to S, a background R symmetry gauge field coupling to the R current J, and a two-form gauge field B mu nu that couples to this C. And I will often use this conserved vector V, which is the dual field strength of B. And moreover, it's important to emphasize that this multiplet is an off-shell supergravity multiplet. Because in dynamical propagating on-shell n equals 1 supergravity, only the metric and the gravitino exist, and these other guys are auxiliary fields. Now, you can couple all of these operators to these sources, and just as before, you'll find that generically supersymmetry is broken for any choice of these backgrounds. So the special bosonic backgrounds, where the gravitino vanishes and you turn on these three bosonic fields, preserve a supercharge Q if and only if the supersymmetry variation of the gravitino vanishes for this choice of bosonic background fields. And I'll give a specific example on the next slide. The good thing about this prescription is that it only depends on the structure of the supercurrent multiplet or, respectively, the supergravity multiplet, and it is independent of other details of the quantum field theory, for example, the matter content. And once you have found such a supersymmetric background, it is very convenient to simply infer the correct coupling of the matter to background fields by starting with the corresponding off-shell supergravity formulas and taking an appropriate limit. Now, this is an approach to supersymmetry on curved space that was emphasized and developed by Fastucci and Zyberg. And I'm being a little brief here, partly because there was a beautiful and detailed review of the subject by Fastucci earlier in this program. And if you're interested, you can look at it online. I will simply restrict myself to giving one example and then proceed. Let's imagine you want to figure out how to write down the curved space Lagrangian for a free chiral multiplet of R charge R. So here are the various components, the complex scalar, the fermion, and the auxiliary field F. And imagine that the scalar has R charge R. Now, if I'm given a bosonic background that satisfies this supersymmetry constraint, delta Q psi equals 0, then in order to find the corresponding curved space Lagrangian, one thing I could do is I could take the linearized coupling to the various R multiplet operators. So for example, here I have the R current, which depends on little r, the R charge, in the usual way. And I think there's a mistake here. That should be R minus 1. The fermion has R charge R minus 1. And also, I've written out one particular term in the stress tensor that takes the form of an improvement term with a coefficient that depends on the R charge. And that relation between this term and the R charge is required by supersymmetry and will be reflected in the Lagrangian in an interesting way. And then one thing you could do is you could couple this to the background fields at the linearized level and simply use the Noether procedure to complete it nonlinearly. This is extremely tedious, but you could, in principle, do it. And what you find is that the curved space Lagrangian takes this form. There's a piece that looks like the flat space Lagrangian, simply covariantized with respect to diffeomorphisms and R-symmetry gauge transformations. So this is some sort of minimal coupling prescription. But then there are also additional pieces that are linear or quadratic in the supergravity background fields. And particularly interesting is this quadratic term that depends on the R charges. And this dependence on the R charges here is a reflection of the fact that this improvement term and the stress tensor dependent on the R charges. However, it is in general much, much easier to simply read off answers like these from a rigid limit of the corresponding off-shell supergravity formulas if these formulas are available. And that's not always the case, but in this case it is. In this case, the appropriate supergravity was described by Sonius and West. It is sometimes referred to as new minimal supergravity. And in this case, Fastucci and Zyberg showed how to get from the supergravity formulas to answers like this. Okay. From now on, we'll be discussing mostly the supersymmetric backgrounds and the stress tensor multiplets without referring to the details of the curved space Lagrangian or the matter content of the theory. Now, I said before that the condition...
maxifier.
Yeah.
Does it change something?
It changes the Lagrangian, but the procedure is the same. Now, I said before that the condition on the bosonic background fields to preserve supersymmetry is that the variation of the gravitino with respect to the supercharge that you want to preserve has to vanish. And if you write out what that condition actually tells you, it leads to a generalized Killing spinner equation for the spinner zeta that parametrizes the corresponding supercharge. And the equation looks like that. So it's some first order linear partial differential equations in the spinner that contains all the background fields in the supergravity multiplet. It depends on the metric, the R-gauge field, and also this vector V, which is the dual field strength of the two form. And such an equation need not always have a solution. There's no guarantee that such an equation has a solution on any manifold or for all values of the background fields. So if you try to analyze precisely when this equation has a solution, you find that it exists if and only if the manifold you're studying is a Hermitian manifold, which means it has an integrable complex structure J, and also a metric that is compatible with that complex structure. So it's a Hermitian metric. Now, there are a few comments I would like to make about this. The first is that in some cases, this procedure is related to twisting. So if M is a Kähler manifold, then the metric has holonomy U2. And in that case, we can simply use the U1 part of that holonomy and the U1R symmetry to do a twist and obtain a conserved supercharge on M. And this corresponds to a solution where you only turn on the R-symmetry gauge field, but you set that other field V to zero. And this case was studied in the early 90s and also more recently by these authors. But in general, M need not be a Kähler manifold. And one of the interesting examples that I will mention later is S3 times S1, which is not a Kähler manifold. And in that case, you need to turn on V, which is precisely proportional to the covariant derivative of the complex structure, which would vanish on a Kähler manifold. Now, perhaps the most important comment is that the resulting supercharge that you find on the complex manifold transforms as a scalar under holomorphic coordinate changes. So that is a comment that will be absolutely crucial in what follows. And moreover, the superalgebra is very simple. You have a simple supercharge. It just squares to zero. And once you have found the supercharge and the metric and the complex structure that you would like to study, then you can simply solve more or less for the other background fields in terms of those objects. The other thing I should say is that I'm only going to discuss the generic situation here where you have a single supercharge. If you'd like more than one supercharge, then of course there are other geometric constraints that your manifold has to study, it has to satisfy. Okay, now if we also want to turn on background gauge fields for continuous flavored symmetries, then we proceed in exactly the same way. In supersymmetry, the flavor current J resides in a multiplet together with other operators. And the corresponding background field, A mu, also resides in an off-shell background supermultiplet together with other fields, D and lambda. Again, lambda here is the gaugino. And as before, we use the same logic. A bosonic configuration of A and D with lambda equals zero preserves the supercharge Q if and only if the variation of the gaugino is zero. And if you write out what those equations tell you, they basically tell you that the 0,2 component of the field strength has to vanish, and D is determined in terms of the remaining components of F. And what that says is that the background gauge field, the supersymmetric background gauge field, determines a holomorphic line bundle over your complex manifold. So we are now in a position to summarize the ingredients that go into the supersymmetric Lagrangian on a complex manifold M. It explicitly depends on the complex structure and the compatible Hermitian metric. And it also explicitly depends on background gauge fields through the holomorphic line bundles they determine. And moreover, it depends on many coupling constants, including those of the original flat space theory, and perhaps other data that I will omit here. Now, it's clear when you look at this that some of this data can be varied continuously. For example, the data in the metric can obviously be varied continuously. You can always do some local deformations of the metric while preserving the fact that it is Hermitian. So the space of possible deformations of this Lagrangian is infinite dimensional. So there's whole functions worth of data that go into defining this curved space Lagrangian. And now what we would like to ask is what fraction or what portion of this data can the partition function actually depend on? So if it is a good BPS observable, we expect it to only depend on a small subset of this data, and this is what we'll try to understand now. So the way we're going to constrain what ZM can depend on is by explicitly varying the continuous data in the Lagrangian and then checking whether the change is Q exact. So I'm writing that schematically here. I'm going to do a small change in the geometry of M. I'm writing that schematically as delta M. And if that change takes the form Q acting on some operator, then the corresponding change in the partition function is the one-point function of this Q of O, and that vanishes by supersymmetry. Now, in principle, to figure out how the Lagrangian varies when you continuously vary J and G and all this other data requires the full nonlinear formalism that I briefly outlined before. However, there's a huge simplification that we can exploit in this case, and that consists of working, working on a general manifold M, we can simply work in a small neighborhood of flat space. So we start with a theory in flat space, and we only vary the metric and the complex structure by a small amount in the vicinity of flat space. And in that case, the deformation Lagrangian simply consists of operators in the stress tensor supermultiplet, whose supersymmetry transformations are known and model independent. So that is a big simplification, but the correct question to ask is why does studying the theory in the vicinity of flat space tell us anything about general manifolds? And the key fact here is the thing I told you a couple of slides ago. The supercharge Q is actually a scalar under holomorphic coordinate changes. And that's a very special property that basically allows you to extend the results that you derive in a vicinity of flat space to arbitrary curved manifolds. And the situation is very similar to what you do in topologically twisted theories. There you also have a supercharge that is a scalar, but now it's a scalar under all coordinate changes on the manifold. And in that case, the flat space stress tensor is also Q of something. And these two ingredients together are enough to ensure that the partition function of the theory on an arbitrary manifold is in fact a topological invariant. It is not entirely obvious. There's an argument to be made. Yes. Of course. So you're only allowed to vary the metric in the class of metrics that preserve supersymmetry. So in the models that I'm considering, you're only allowed to vary the metric as long as you preserve the fact that it is Hermitian and so forth. They need not be connected, but the argument that proving something about the vicinity of flat space implies the result for general manifolds does not depend on this. I'm not saying that you can extract the answer for a disconnected component from the data in the vicinity of flat space. All I'm saying is that if I understand what data can influence the partition function at all in a vicinity of flat space, that tells me what data can influence the partition function for general backgrounds. That's the only information I will need. Okay, so we're going to do that now. We're going to consider small changes of the complex structure and small changes of the metric. And we're going to use holomorphic coordinates adapted to the original complex structure. And in that case, of course, you need to ensure that the deformations still preserve the conditions that I said before. You need to preserve the integrability of the complex structure and the hermeticity of the metric. And these are these conditions here. These are the usual integrability conditions for deformation of complex structure. There's kind of a cohomology problem here, because infinitesimal deformations of the complex structure that are induced by an infinitesimal diffeomorphism are supposed to be trivial. So non-trivial complex structure deformations correspond by taking solutions of this and quotienting by trivial solutions of this form. And so that means that complex structure deformations or complex structure moduli are parametrized by cohomology classes in this Dolbeau cohomology group. So this is the 0-1 Dolbeau cohomology group with coefficients in the holomorphic tangent bundle. And if M is a compact manifold, the important thing for us will be that there are only finitely many complex structure moduli. So now I can just take my linearized Lagrangian coupled to background fields, the metric couples to the stress tensor and so forth, and I can simply plug in the variations I had on the previous slide using the fact that I know how A and B depend on the metric and the complex structure. And what I obtain is a Lagrangian for the infinitesimal deformation that I wanted to study. So I have here a Lagrangian whose coefficients are the variation of the Hermitian metric and the variation of the complex structure, and the operators that it multiplies are some combination of operators in the stress tensor multiplet. I've defined here this operator curly T that you see is some relatively complicated combination of operators in the flat space stress tensor multiplet. And this T, together with some derivatives of the R current, multiplies the various deformations that I can consider. Okay? So this is the most general supersymmetric deformation of the Lagrangian in the vicinity of flat space. And now we would like to ask whether any of these deformations multiply an operator that is Q exact. Okay? Now, the good thing is that we know that since T and this guy here all live in the supercurrent multiplet, the only operators that we need to check are the ones that live in the supercurrent multiplet. And the only fermionic operator in the supercurrent multiplet is the supersymmetry current S itself. So we simply check the Q variation of S is 0. That's guaranteed by the R symmetry in this case. And the Q variation of its complex conjugate is some combination of components in curly T. So the components of curly T that have an anti-holomorphic I-bar index in the second slot are Q exact. And now we can simply look at the deformation Lagrangian and read off when this happens. So it clearly happens here. Here we have a J-bar. And that means that variations of the Hermitian metric are Q exact. Therefore, the partition function cannot depend on them. Similarly, this term here is also Q exact. And that means that the partition function cannot depend on this holomorphic combination of delta J. It can only depend on this one. And you see that this one has no reason to be Q exact because it does not have an I bar index in the second slot. So what that means is that the partition function depends holomorphically on these delta J I J bar. And therefore, it means that it is, in fact, a holomorphic function of the complex structure moduli. OK. Now, we can immediately say a couple of things using just these results. So the fact that the answer has to be independent of the Hermitian metric, in particular, means that it is invariant under rescalings, under constant rescalings with some scale lambda. And what that shows is that the partition function is a renormalization group invariant. Okay? I can do this rescaling, which is Q trivial and doesn't affect the partition function. And that allows me to compute the partition function either in the UV or in the IR or anywhere else along the RG flow that is convenient. And similarly, it shows that the partition function must be duality invariant if you have two renormalization group flows that flow to the same IR fixed point. Doing these dilatations along the two flows shows you that the partition functions have to be the same. Yeah? I can use any description of the theory at any point along the RG flow. Now, I've said that the partition function has to be holomorphic in the complex structure moduli. That's slightly imprecise. The argument I made only shows that it is locally holomorphic. And in fact, it is known from examples that there can be singularities as you go to certain special values in complex structure moduli space. These are very interesting, and they're as of yet poorly understood. But presumably, they encode some interesting physics. So that should be understood better. And as I said before, if M is a compact manifold, then the number of complex structure moduli is finite. And this is a clear illustration of the fact that supersymmetry has reduced the parameter dependence of the partition function from an infinite number of parameters, which is the whole set of functional dependence that goes into defining the Lagrangian, to a finite number of complex structure moduli. No, there is an interesting renormalization group flow, but only partition function is invariant. Basically, what this says is that renormalization group flow is sufficiently Q exact to not affect the answer. Morally speaking, it only affects the D terms. That's not quite true because, but yeah. Okay. And finally, we can run the same argument to flavor currents and discuss the dependence on background gauge fields. And in that case, remember that we said that background gauge fields define holomorphic line bundles over the complex manifold. And the same logic shows that the partition function only depends on the holomorphic line bundle moduli. And moreover, it is a holomorphic function of them. Okay, one brief example in four dimensions before we move on, example studied by many, many people, is complex surfaces diffeomorphic to S3 times S1. So Kodaira has shown that such complex manifolds must be what are called primary hop surfaces. Primary hop surfaces are defined as a quotient of C2 minus the origin in this fashion. And the quotient depends on two complex numbers, P and Q, which have to lie in the unit disk and satisfy this inequality. So this produces a complex manifold with two complex structure moduli, P and Q. And if you compute the partition function on this space, we can immediately say that it has to be a holomorphic function of P and Q. And if there also turn out to be abelian background gauge fields, then the partition function must be a locally holomorphic function of the corresponding line bundle modulus U, of which there is only one on this space. And one thing that I will briefly mention, but I will not have time to elaborate on, is the fact that this partition function on Hopf surfaces is nothing but the supersymmetric index, I of P, Q, and U, for states on the supersymmetric theory on the round S3 times R. So this is a theory that was studied by many authors, and it can be used to define a supersymmetric index, and that index is nothing but the partition function on this general Hopf surface at general complex fugacities. Now, if the theory you study happens to be superconformal, then this index is known to count BPS operators in the flat space theory. And at the end of the talk, if I have time, I will come back to comment on that. OK, now we'll leave four dimensions behind, and we'll move on to three dimensions. 3D n equals 2 theories with an R symmetry are very closely related to the 4D theories I just discussed. They're essentially related by twisted dimensional reduction. And in this case, the R multiplet that contains the stress tensor and the supersymmetry current is very similar, still contains the R current, S, T, and some other operators that are the analogs of that C we had in four dimensions. And then we can also write down the corresponding background supergravity fields, which again look very similar. Of course, there's the metric and the gravitino, the R symmetry gauge field, and then there are two other background fields that couple to these additional operators. C here is the three-dimensional graviphoton that couples to the central charge current of the 3D theory. And now we can again look at what the condition delta psi equals 0 for supersymmetric backgrounds tells us. And it leads, like in four dimensions, to something like a Killing spinner equation. It looks very similar. There are some extra terms here that depend on the additional background fields. But essentially, we can study it in exactly the same fashion. And we can ask when it has solutions. And it turns out that a Killing spinner exists if and only if the manifold, the three manifold you're studying, admits a structure called a transversely holomorphic foliation. And the metric is transversely Hermitian. So this sounds like a mouthful, but it's actually relatively easy to define. A transversely holomorphic foliation is essentially a 2 plus 1 decomposition of your 3 manifold that's specified by a nowhere vanishing vector field. So you have a vector field C, which provides a local decomposition into an orthogonal two-dimensional space and a space along C. And then on that orthogonal two-dimensional space, you can define an integrable complex structure, J, and you demand that J is invariant under flows along C. Okay? This sounds like an unfamiliar space, but in fact, they are very well understood. They've been completely classified in the compact case by these two authors. And topologically, it turns out that such manifolds are very restricted. They are either Seifert manifolds, which means S2 bundles over a Riemann surface, or they're themselves T2 bundles over S1. Importantly, what this means is that supersymmetry on three manifolds disallows hyperbolic manifolds, which is a huge and interesting class of three manifolds. And the only point that I want to make in this slide is that these spaces are, on the one hand, very well understood, and on the other hand, extremely similar to complex manifolds. Okay, this structure allows you to define close analogs of all the things you know and love from complex geometry. So for example, you can define holomorphic PQ forms. You can define a notion of a D-bar operator. There's a notion of Dolbeau cohomology. There's an analog of what you might call a holomorphic line bundle. And unsurprisingly, these analogs of holomorphic line bundle are exactly what parameterize supersymmetric configurations for background gauge fields. And finally, both these transversely holomorphic foliations and these holomorphic line bundles are parameterized by a finite number of complex moduli that are given by certain cohomology classes of this D-bar operator. So the story is extremely, extremely similar to what we had in the complex case in four dimensions. And just like we did there, we can analyze what data actually enters the partition function. So the Lagrangian depends on all of the geometry that I just described. Depends on the transversely holomorphic foliation, depends on the choice of transversely Hermitian metric, and of course also on background gauge fields through holomorphic line bundles. And just as we did in 4D, we can run a Q-exactness argument with the supercurrent and find that the only thing that the partition function depends on are the holomorphic moduli of the transversely holomorphic foliation and the holomorphic moduli of the line bundles. The metric simply disappears with all the consequences. So now we can use this understanding to explain various things about squashed free spheres that I summarized at the beginning of the talk. So if you look at the moduli space of transversely holomorphic foliations on manifolds that are diffeomorphic to a free sphere, you can find, basically from the work of these two authors, that the component of that moduli space that is continuously connected to the round sphere that was studied by these authors is one-dimensional, one complex dimensional. And what that shows is that all squashed sphere partition functions can only depend on the geometry through a single complex parameter, which is nothing but the squashing parameter B that has already been discussed in the literature. But this result is true regardless of how complicated the geometry of the squashing is. So any squashing of S3 will result in a one-parameter partition function, which coincides with the one that was already found. And it also shows that no matter what else you do to the free sphere to squash it in various ways, on this branch of deformations, you will never find interesting new answers. Moreover, these observations also explain why they are squashing the change the metric and change the geometry, but don't affect the answer at all. And such deformations simply correspond to changes in the geometry that keeps the transversely holomorphic foliation fixed, but changes the metric. Okay? So we've explained those two aspects. Okay. Now, in the last 5 minutes, I would like to return to a point that I've alluded to various times throughout the talk. I've described supersymmetric theories on S3 times S1, and also S3, the round S3. And in general, the procedure I described places supersymmetry on these spaces in a way that explicitly depends on a choice of R symmetry. We saw earlier that the Lagrangian depends explicitly on the R charges, and this choice is encoded from the very beginning into the formalism through the choice of R multiple. Okay? Now, if you have a superconformal field theory and you want to study it on these spaces, you can do that by doing a conformal transformation from flat space. And that completely fixes the curvature couplings. Okay? So if you want to get agreement between these two procedures, you need to tune the R charges to a special value. And of course, the correct special value is that you have to tune them to the superconformal R symmetry of the theory. And that has to be determined independently. So in four dimensions, there's a well-known recipe for determining the R charges of the superconformal theory directly from flat space. And that procedure is A-maximization. Now, in 3D, there's an analogous principle called F-maximization that allows you to determine the superconformal R symmetry. And the recipe goes as follows. Consider the partition function on a round sphere, so the metric is round, but you turn on a background gauge field for a global flavor symmetry J. And as I've discussed on the previous slides, the partition function can only depend on background gauge fields through a single holomorphic line bundle modulus. Turns out that on S3, there's only a single holomorphic line bundle modulus, so the partition function will only depend on one complex parameter U. Here I will phrase the discussion in terms of the free energy S, which is related to the partition function as follows. And if we decompose U into the real and imaginary part, we can call the real part M and the imaginary part T. So F is a holomorphic function of this combination. And it turns out that the physical interpretation of this imaginary part T is that it controls the mixing of the flavor current J with the R symmetry, as was pointed out by these authors. Okay? Now, of course, that means that if I vary T, I'm doing something that involves coupling to the flavor current multiplet. And indeed, computing derivatives of this object with respect to T simply inserts correlation functions of the flavor current and its superpartners. Okay? And now you can use superconformal symmetry in the special case where you are at the superconformal point to say something about what these derivatives should be. So for example, you know that one-point functions of that current in the superconformal theory should vanish. And that means that computing a first derivative of the real part of F at the CFT point has to be 0. This derivative which through this chain of reasoning simply couples to J, brings down a one-point function of J, and that has to be 0 in a CFT. Okay? So this condition, which is an extremization condition, can be used to fix the superconformal R symmetry. Now, if you compute more derivatives, you obtain more data. So for example, if you take a second derivative, you bring down two copies of J. And loosely speaking, the data that you will get is related to the two-point function of J at separated points, which is controlled by a single positive number tau. And if you trace through the various steps, you'll find that the second derivative is, in fact, some universal negative constant times tau, so it has to be negative. And what that shows is that the real part of F is, in fact, maximized at the superconformal point. So this is F maximization, and it is the exact analog of A maximization in three dimensions, and it allows you to determine the superconformal R symmetry. Now, there are various subtleties and additional data that I omitted because, essentially, F also has an imaginary part, but I will not have time to go into that here. The thing that I wanted to conclude with is the statement that once you have found the correct superconformal R symmetry, you can use this formula to compute tau. Okay? So you can use this formula to extract the two-point function of flavor currents in the superconformal theory. And if you compute higher T derivatives, you simply bring down more copies of the flavor current, and that allows you to compute certain integrated higher point correlation functions of J in the superconformal theory. Now, if you want to compute correlation functions of other operators in the superconformal theory, you're going to have to turn on some other source for them. But we already know one operator and one source that we've studied in great detail. Namely, we can squash the sphere, and that couples to the stress tensor and its friends. So if we squash the sphere slightly for the superconformal choice of R symmetry, and we compute derivatives with respect to the squashing parameter around the round sphere, then we compute integrated correlation functions of the stress tensor. Okay? So for example, you can compute the two-point function of the stress tensor in the superconformal theory, which is sometimes denoted as CT, by taking a second derivative of the free energy with respect to the squashing parameter and evaluate it at the round sphere. So this is a machine for computing superconformal correlation functions in the flat space theory by doing something on the sphere. And one interesting question that was already raised by Zohar yesterday is whether these protected correlation functions in flat space can somehow be directly extracted by doing a flat space computation without going to the sphere. Okay. That allows me to conclude more or less on time. So I've reviewed for you the fact that supersymmetric quantum field theories on curved manifolds can be described using background supergravity fields. And around flat space, that coupling proceeds through the stress tensor multiplet of the theory. And that stress tensor multiplet is a very powerful tool for analyzing the curved space theory. And I've demonstrated this fact by arguing that if you take a four-dimensional n equals 1 theory with an R symmetry and place it on a complex manifold, the partition function does not depend on the Hermitian metric, and it depends holomorphically on the complex structure moduli. And we also obtained similar results for 3D n equals 2 theories with an R symmetry and used that to explain certain facts about the squashed sphere, and you can apply that in many other examples in the literature. Now, these arguments are useful because they constrain the partition function even in situations where it hasn't been explicitly computed using localization. So in some sense, you can view this approach as being a complement to explicit localization computations. And again, I would like to emphasize that even though I've discussed very restricted examples, the method is general, and it can be applied to many classes of theories in diverse dimensions and with different amounts of supersymmetry. So I think I'll stop here. Thank you.
Is this on? Yeah. Question, if the partition function doesn't depend on the Hermitian metric, mm-hmm. how is that consistent with the non-vanishing of the anomalous trace of the stress tensor?
That's a very interesting question, and actually a subtle question. Basically, the answer has two parts. The first part is that everything I've told you essentially ignores the possibility of anomalies. Okay? So it is, as of yet, an open problem to understand carefully the effect of anomalies in this kind of discussion. Now, it is known that the trace coefficients of the stress tensor make a subtle appearance in various of these partition functions, but not in the way that you're necessarily familiar with from the untwisted case, or from the case where you don't have these two exactness arguments. So, for example, there's a you might ask a similar question even in topologically twisted theories, like the ones that Witten studied. There he proved that the answer has to be completely independent of the metric. And you could also ask, where's the stress tensor? And in fact, in those examples, it has been studied explicitly that the contribution of the anomaly simply cancels. So in those examples, the supersymmetry persists in the way that I've described, even at the quantum level, and the dependence of the metric through the anomaly also cancels. However, in some of the examples I described, for example, S3 times S1, it is known that the anomaly coefficients make a subtle appearance. So that is an interesting question that remains to be understood.
I wonder, you know, in this, what you call partition function, does it apply that you are integrating over fermion and boson with periodic boundary conditions? So, you know, that this notion partition function could be referred to something which is similar to index calculation, right?
Yes. So generally, there's only one choice of spin structure that preserves supersymmetry. So you're asking about fermion boundary conditions.
Yeah.
So you have to choose a spin structure.
So in this way, it's like index, right?
It is like index. And moreover, I should say that I've described, for example, supersymmetric theories on complex manifolds. On complex manifolds, there's a essentially canonical choice of what's called a spin C structure, which is, in fact, good enough to specify all the boundary conditions you need. So the geometry of the complex manifold actually tells you which periodicities you should pick to preserve supersymmetry.
OK, thank you.
I was wondering if you could, I'm over here, if you could summarize the situation in two dimensions. Is there a C maximization or what's?
There is a C maximization in two dimensions, yes. But just like in four dimensions, since it relies on the conformal anomalies, it is essentially a flat space trick. It's something you can do directly in flat space. You don't need to go to the sphere. So in four dimensions, you have A maximization, and in two dimensions, you have C maximization. And because these only depend on anomalies, you can carry out this computation directly in flat space. In three dimensions, we've learned, you know, in many talks this week, that the correct analog of A and C is the three-sphere partition function. And that's the same spirit in which F maximization utilizes the three-sphere partition function in order to fix the R symmetry. There, you don't have an analog of A and C.
And what about the rest of the story you told in terms of it depending only on the complex structure and
right? So there's a story there which has been partially uncovered. So for example, several groups have studied partition functions of 2.2 theories on a round sphere, and it was found that this partition function actually computes some quantum Kähler potential of the corresponding Calabi-Yau sigma model. Now, in order to prove that fact, you might want to relate the partition function on the round sphere to some type of infinite cylinder geometry, where you can use something like the TT star equations to argue that, in fact, you're computing the quantum Kähler potential. So you, again, need to use some deformation argument to go from the round sphere to this infinite cylinder geometry. And that argument was made by various groups, and it proceeds in a very similar way. You find some deformation that doesn't affect the partition function. You can either see that by constructing a deformed sphere and explicitly calculating and checking that the answer doesn't depend on it, or you can try to make a general argument just based on some Q exactness.
Is there some you started with this supergravity multiplet, say for n equals 1, 4d. Is there some reason that you know there are other possible off-shell supergravity multiplets with different auxiliary fields? Is there some understanding that this is the right one for these kinds of questions? If, for example, you shouldn't take one with even more auxiliary fields?
No, indeed, it's a choice. So it's a choice at the very beginning of the process. You first have to choose which multiplet the stress tensor lives in. And different choices lead to different off-shell formulations of supergravity, and they can give rise to completely different classes of backgrounds. So I've chosen one particular supergravity multiplet, which is manifestly compatible with the R symmetry of the theory. that has led to a certain rich story, which makes contact with many examples. But for example, you could also choose a different formulation of supergravity. One notable omission from the list of manifolds that I've characterized, for example, in four dimensions, is simply S4, because S4 is not a complex manifold. If you wish to place an n equals 1 theory on S4, you can do that, but then you have to use precisely one of the alternative formulations of supergravity. What's interesting or problematic in that case is that that formulation coupled to S4 manifestly breaks the R symmetry of the theory, and that makes many of the arguments that I presented here substantially more difficult.
If you formulate your theories on superspace, normally you have to have integrals over full superspace and also chiral superspace. Is it the case your partition functions never depend on the parameters in the chiral superspace parts?
That's a very good question. So in general, my theories on complex manifolds only preserve a single Q. And that might lead you to suspect that they will not depend on half of the chiral data, but they could depend on the other half. Okay. That possibility remains. What's a fact is that nobody has yet studied an example and done an explicit computation where dependence on the F terms has emerged explicitly. And the reason for that is that almost all examples that have been studied preserve, in fact, not just one Q, but something like a Q and a Q bar. And then you can use the combination of the two to show that both the chiral F-term data and the anti-chiral F-term data drops out of the answer. I should say, though, that there is one important way in which the F-terms influence these answers, and that's through the choice of R-symmetry, right? Because the superpotential restricts the possible allowed R-symmetries, and the R-symmetry directly enters these Lagrangians and partition functions.
More questions?
This question may be a naive one, but you have a Q-exact structure in your system. Can you discretize your system while preserving that Q-exact structure?
It's a very interesting question. I don't know the answer. I can just say something general and hope that it makes sense. So in the examples you've studied where it's possible to preserve some supersymmetry in a discretized structure, usually that supersymmetry has something to do with twisting.
Indeed.
Now, the procedure here is a generalization of twisting, but it still involves twisting in an essential way. So because the R-symmetry gauge field plays an important role and the supercharge is in a suitable sense a scalar. So you might hope that there is indeed some way of playing this game, but I have nothing to say about it.
It may be quite interesting, actually.
Any more questions?
All right.
Okay, if not, let's thank Thomas again.
Thank you.